In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, before we get going, I want to tell you a little bit about our sponsor, Casper. Casper has a new way to sell mattresses to you, and it is way better than the old way. The old way was going to a dealership and paying too much for a crappy mattress. The new way is you order it online, you get a great price, and it gets delivered to your house in a box. This cannot be beat. If you go to casper.com/longform, you'll get $50 off your order, and you'll be supporting this show. Here is the show. Hey, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer here, unfortunately, with only Max Linsky as Evan continues to be a father.
His absence is, it's extended at this point.
It's going to be funny when this show is archived in like 25 years and Evan's child is like a urban professional living in New York, listening back to this period wall. Yeah, okay. This week on the show, we've got Ian Urbina. This was actually a fun show because usually I have an idea to do something and then I'm like, oh, I don't have time now. And then 6 months later, I remember it. But I was leisurely opening my New York Times. I noticed this incredible series that he has been doing about crime on the deep seas. And an email later, he was in our studio telling us about it. It's something he's worked on for over a year, I believe. It's a 4-part series, which I think today or tomorrow, the last part of, is coming out. They're really, really excellent. I recommend checking him out and then hearing him. I mean, this is a massive project.
I'm sure you guys get into all the details of the story, so I don't want to spoil any of them. A thing that I did not understand before reading those stories is that there's basically like no law.
Yes. It's like an anomaly in the world. So, yeah, thanks to Ian for coming in. As always, thanks to Tiny Letter for sponsoring the show. It's a simple, powerful email newsletter tool to get any old thing you want to communicate about out to an audience.
Thanks, as always, to Tiny Letter, but a special thank you this week to Tiny Letter.
Yeah. I don't even know why, but sure.
Well, here's why. Together, son of a bitch.
Can we start a campaign on this show? Write in if you would like Max to change the music that plays when his cell phone goes off. I'm going to describe it. It's music that you would expect to be at a carousel.
Should we play it again?
Yeah, play it one more time.
Okay, hold on. I just think it's like a good...
We can take a user poll here, actually.
I think it's a good old-time melody.
Let me know if you think this is an appropriate... ringtone for an adult man.
It's called By the Seaside, Aaron, and I think it's just... That's where it goes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, By the Seaside, that's right. Yeah, it is. It's what it would be playing at, like a disgusting British resort town's carousel.
I actually think that the reason I have never thought this realized this before. I actually think that the reason that is my ringtone is because I have this memory of walking outside the boardwalk in Atlantic City after losing like a really unfortunate amount of money in craps. That song is playing, and I was just not quite drunk enough to have lost that much money.
So we were talking about why we're double, quadruple thanking MailChimp this week.
This is why.
Why?
We are throwing a party with MailChimp.
Yeah.
With the great folks at Tiny Letter.
Third anniversary of this podcast.
Yes. We have done so many episodes. We've been doing this for 3 years, and we figured it was time to finally celebrate. And so we're throwing this party with Tiny Letter, our longtime sponsors. And here's the party. This is the idea for the party.
Pitch it to me.
It's only people who have appeared on the show.
Yes. Yes.
So it's a small party.
Yeah.
You can't come unless you have been a guest on the show.
It's elitist.
It is elitist. But we've decided that if it's going to be the celebration of the show, and that's the idea, right? It's just to sort of like take the show offline, put all these people in a room together.
To celebrate ourselves, yes.
Yeah.
Because we need to get celebrated.
I know. I mean, it's been minutes since I was celebrated.
Yeah.
That we figured if we were actually going to try and represent the show, we should at least let a few listeners be there.
Yeah. A few, though. Don't get too full of yourselves, listeners.
So here's what I'm driving at. We would love to have some people who listen to the show at this party. The party is going to be in New York. It's in August. Here is what you should do, because we have to get something out of the deal. We can't just give you something.
Yeah.
So you should leave a review for the show in iTunes. That's what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Go on iTunes, leave us a review, and then send an email to podcast@longform.org and just, I don't know, like say your Apple username.
Say what name the review
Find
is
some way of proving that you
I
did
will,
it.
I'll be checking. I'm going to check everyone. I don't want anyone trying to pull one past me on this front. Leave a review, and we'll put all the names in a hat, and we'll draw some out and invite you to this party if you're going to be in New York in August. If you're not in New York, maybe enter anyway, and you could have one of your friends go. I don't know. The possibilities are endless, but there are going to be some celebrities at this party.
It is going to be a really fun party, and much like this show, it straight up would not be happening without MailChimp.
Yes. If this show, without MailChimp, this party would be at Max's house, and we'd have to go to bed at 7 p.m. because of Guy.
Guy's coming to the party.
Oh, yeah? You can bring him?
Fuck no. He goes to bed at 6 o'clock.
Okay.
Throw it to yourself, dude. Do it.
For the first time ever, I'm throwing myself it. Here is me with Ian Urbina from the New York Times. Hey. Welcome. You are the author of a four-part New York Times series that concluded, I think when this airs, it'll have just concluded that day. They were kind enough to give me a little sneak peek of it so we could tape this in advance. But tell us what the connective thread is between these four stories.
So the series is called The Outlaw Ocean, and at root it's about the lawlessness of the high seas and attempts to sort of take the readers, most of whom I don't think have ever been out to this space, and show them kind of some of the things that happen out there in the realm of labor, human rights, and environmental abuses.
Yeah.
And just sort of general illegality and mischief. And the sort of the thought originally was a simple one. It was that, you know, 2/3 of the planet is covered by water, and much of that water is ungoverned and ungovernable, and we rarely get to go there or hear about the people that work there.
I'm curious as how you pitch a story like this. You're like, the ocean, all of it, everything that's happening in it.
It's a funny story. I mean, so I'm an investigative reporter and I work on longer projects.
Yeah.
And I sat down with my editor, and normally we have a conversation about what the next big project will be in January. And on this occasion, it was December, and I wasn't prepared. And she said, so what are you thinking about next? And she's someone with a very busy schedule, and when she asks you a question, she wants an answer then. So I sort of just shot from the hip. I worked on a ship for a while before joining the Times. I've always been fascinated with the ocean. You know, if you offered me a ticket to the moon or a ticket to the furthest spot on the sea, I'd take the latter in a second. So I just said, I think our readers would really love to go out there, and I certainly would like to, and I know for a fact there are lots of really good stories.
Let's start actually with you used to work on a ship. So how did that come about?
I don't want to overstate it because it was a very short stint. It was about 3.5 months. And I was in grad school in a doctoral program for anthropology, and I was really burnt out. And I wanted to do something, you know, to kind of clear my head. And a friend of mine had worked on a ship, a research vessel, and one thing led to another. She put me in touch with the right people, and I got a job on that ship to work as sort of a resident anthropologist. The funny part of it is we barely got out on the high seas, so it wasn't much of an exposure, but we stayed on the ship the whole time, and just the whole world that mariners live in and how oddly divorced they are from, even when they're in port, how oddly separated they are from the rest of us struck me as fascinating. I knew I always wanted to get back to it.
So you have a background in anthropology. Mm. What was your intention with anthropology doctoral?
I kind of goofed around in undergrad and only started paying attention, you know, my senior year, and realizing, wow, this is, you know, some interesting stuff going on in these classes.
Yeah.
So I realized I wanted to stay in school a little longer. I applied to grad school, and I went to the University of Chicago, and they had a dual program in history and anthropology, a dual doctoral program. I always knew I didn't want to be a professor. It wasn't a lifestyle that attracted me, but I did really like the notion of staying sort of in the life of the mind for a little longer and finding ways to get to exotic places. And anthropology seemed like a really fast ticket. And just quite frankly, the most interesting people I met were anthropologists, so I just started specializing in that.
This time series, it's four stories, and they have a loose connective tissue of like people who work on boats. So when you take a culture like people who work on boats, which is tens of thousands of probably hundreds of thousands of people worldwide, and you look at that from the lens of anthropology, like how would you go about studying like a group of that kind?
You know, it is a tribe, you know, and it has its norms and its language and its sort of jealousies. Mm-hmm. And I just approached it as almost a foreign country that happened to be disparate and, it, you know, almost like a nomadic or exiled population, and one that had a really, you know, it has its own norms, like extremely strict hierarchies. You know, when you're on a ship, the captain is God, and, you know, really severe discipline and pretty admirable work ethic. And what's funny too, I'll just say, is these little kind of chunks of land that are floating around the globe are also super international.
Almost post-national in a way.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. One thing I was struck by early on was that a fourth, I think, is statistic of all mariners globally come from one tiny country, and that's the Philippines.
Wow. What's the historical root behind the Philippines supplying the entire world's sailing force?
It's the same one that explains why so many nurses in the U.S. are Filipino. The country made a decision, I don't know what years, maybe the 70s, that its product of export was going to be people, and people targeted towards certain professions. And so the Philippines have poured a lot of resources into nursing schools for the women and, you know, seafarer schools for the men. Oh. And so it's got a huge concentration of them. And also, it's a fairly educated, relatively, compared to other relatively poor countries, its population speaks English and is better educated. And so that combination makes them perfect for work on ships.
Hey, I'm going to pause things for a quick second to tell you about our sponsor, Casper. They have a better way of selling you a premium mattress that they've obsessively engineered for quality. If you've been to a dealership or a showroom or whatever these mattress places are called, they've probably charged you too much for a pretty crappy mattress and a crappy experience. Instead, Casper has cut them entirely out of the equation, which allows them to sell you an American-made premium latex and memory foam mattress for a fraction of the price, namely about $500 for a twin size,
$850 for a queen, $950 for king. The best part is you don't have to go anywhere. They send it to your house in this cool box that doesn't seem like it would fit a mattress, but it does. Once you get it, you have 100 days to sleep on it with no obligation. If you don't like it, send it back. You will have paid nothing. This is a great deal. It's a great way to invest in yourself and your good night's sleep, a place you spend one third of your life. Your mattress should be awesome. So I want you to go to casper.com/longform. You'll get $50 off and you'll be supporting this show. Thank you, Casper. Again, casper.com/longform. Here I am back with Ian Urbina. What were your entry points into this world? Where, when you were starting off and you had blurted out the ocean and crime, I mean, this is a very insular world that isn't really very happy about being scrutinized. What points did you start probing to try and get inside?
We had, Weebing, my editor, and I had a list of things, of targets, you know, topical targets. And the hardest among them was the sea slaves story as a target. Our goal was to go to the South China Sea, where there was and is a notoriously acute forced labor problem, and try to actually get on the boats where the quote-unquote slaves are. There'd been a fair amount of good, impressive reporting on land, but very little, if any, I've not found it from the boats themselves. And the boats in particular, there's an institution called transshipment, and it essentially means because fuel has become so expensive and because overfishing has stripped the oceans of many of its fish, to catch enough fish, you have to go much further out from shore than you did 20, 30 years ago. So that means that the sort of cost-benefit analysis has changed. And so the structure of the industry has changed, whereby long-haul fishing boats can't make money if they bring their catch back to shore. So they stay out there and they just keep fishing. And a mothership comes out and takes the catch, brings ice, fuel, supplies, sometimes men, out and takes the catch back. But the fishing boat just stays out there. And those are the boats, the long-haul transshipment boats, the ones that stay out there, the ones that had the really, really severe cases of slavery. And we knew that, everyone knew that, but the challenge was to try to get out on one of them.
Each one of these stories has sort of what you describe as a poster child in it. So there's the worst ship. There is this video of people being shot in the water after being thrown overboard. And then there's this tale of captivity. And then I guess the fourth one is about the worst fishing boat, kind of?
The longest chase.
The longest chase.
Yeah.
So in choosing those, I mean, how many poster children did you consider for the series?
So to go in order, the first story was the Donna Liberta, and the hope, the goal there was to find... It's hard to find the worst ship.
Yeah.
So we wanted to find a bad ship that would serve well as a sort of poster child of perhaps a diversity of crimes that occur.
Right.
That actually was one of the hardest parts of the series, was finding which ship to use.
Yeah, it seems like it's easier to find a good person than a good boat.
That's right. And, you know, they're inanimate things, and so you're kind of... especially if you haven't dug into them to figure out, well, will I be able to find any of the crew and can I find these stowaways, etc. You're just going on, you know, okay, we know that this ship engaged in three categories of crime. It tossed two stowaways overboard and put them on a raft and cut them there, left them in the middle of the ocean, and it dumped oil and caused a 90-mile slick, and it abandoned a bunch of crew in port. But will it make for a good tale? We don't know.
Yeah.
But we liked that Donna Liberta just because the categories of misbehavior were interesting and diverse. And some of them were, like, you know, really representative of big problems,
right,
that were broad. So it wasn't sort of cherry-picked. So the slave story was the kind of thing where, much thanks to my bosses, they said, just go. We don't know what you're going to find, but just go to the region and just get on the ground and start digging around. So we didn't have any idea how we were going to frame that story. And then that took a lot of effort and a lot of time. We were out on the South China Sea for 5 weeks and jumping all over the region and getting on a lot of boats. And Lang Long emerged late in that reporting. That story actually has two poster children in some ways, in that Lang Long is a single individual whose story we talk about, but there's also the boat that we got on, which is a boat. It's a Thai-flagged Cambodian crude vessel that we spent a fair amount of time on and got to see what the conditions look like. Mm-hmm. And then the other two were sort of no-brainers. The Longest Chase was just kind of, it rode itself. You know, yeah. This was a ship that was on the most wanted list of Interpol, and kind of was the most wanted Interpol vessel for illegal fishing. And lo and behold, a chase was underway and it went from Antarctica to Africa. And the scramble there was logistical, because getting on the chaser vessel was tough. If they peeled off for too far, the culprit was going to get away. And so we had to figure out how we could catch up with them and get on board while they were en route.
This brings up an interesting question for me, which is, when you're, say, reporting within the United States, someone might say, hey, I don't want the story written about me. Don't come on my property. Get off my lawn. But you can still write the story about them. You can still, you know, sit outside their house and do all the things reporters do. When you were trying to get on, like in the case of this slave ship, what's your pitch to be even let on a ship as a New York Times reporter?
You know, it's funny because it sounds harder than it is. The convincing them, whoever they, that captain is less difficult the further out you get. So in that case, we hopscotched. The first jump was the biggest challenge. Getting from the port onto the first vessel was the one that really took, you know, cajoling and pleading. And because there was a lot of attention going towards Thailand about their slave problem.
Yeah.
So in the ports, those folks were very aware of kind of Western faces, Western human rights workers, Western journalists, you know, kind of throwing bad light on them. And so when we would meet captains who were willing to take us out, not to let us on their ship, they were just boat captains that moved, they were mothership captains, nothing bad was happening, but they would take us 50 miles out and get us on another boat, they were most adamant about us not getting on board from port. So we'd have to take a small skiff out 10 miles, get on their boat, go out 50 miles. They would radio another captain. They'd talk them into putting us on their boat. They'd take us out 50 more. And so we hopscotched, and the boat that we profile, it took 3 jumps before we got onto that Cambodian crude boat.
When you've made that third jump and you realize you're probably 3 jumps back to port, are you frightened at a situation like that?
Yeah, I was on that trip. We had only one satellite phone, and if that went, we were completely cut off. We had talked with the consultant that the Times has for this sort of reporting, and he had said he thought this was really risky because there's no way for them to know where we are.
Right. You can't kill a reporter in a lot of parts of the world, but you could throw a reporter overboard and who would know, right?
It was scary in many ways, but I don't want to overstate the threat.
Yeah.
Because the reality is, the further out you got, the less the crew and the captains out there had any awareness of us as a threat. We were just some strange guys that oddly wanted onto their rat-infested ship and wanted to document the work they do, period. They couldn't care less. So long as we stayed out of their way, they were just sort of bemused. And the notion of them harming us was also a sort of non sequitur for them, because there was no advantage. You know, they could keep our equipment. What are they going to do with our equipment? They could. And so really, in retrospect, the danger on those boats was conditions, you know, getting around the sanitary conditions, the gear, the weather, and just not falling overboard. But the crews themselves they don't see themselves as doing wrong, and they don't see us as a threat.
Is there a maritime press? Like, is there someone who covers this world?
So Lloyd's is kind of the powerhouse in maritime coverage, and it's been out of London, and they do Lloyd's List, and they do amazing kind of consistent maritime coverage. But they're covering a whole different realm of shipping. You know, it's Maersk, it's Captain Phillips ships, you know, it's the big stuff,
right.
Tankers, and they're not covering trawlers in the South China Sea that are, you know, ghost ships and aren't registered. And so no, there's no press covering this realm of...
So in some ways, they're covering the big ships that some of these smaller ships are sort of a shadow industry that supports. Like these guys who are on these ships off the coast of Africa who do sort of gig-based security and are just waiting for a ship to defend. That's someone who would maybe be employed by a Maersk kind of shipper.
So think of it as two different industries. One is shipping, and they move stuff. And within shipping, you'll have fuel tankers moving oil, or you'll have cargo ships moving grain, you know, bulk carriers. And then you'll have container ships like the one Captain Phillips. That's shipping. And then there's, fishing. And it's all own different realm. Mm. And you have the big players, huge multi-million-dollar longliners, tuna longliners, and, you know, big companies. None of them are as big as the Maersk ships. And then you have a gazillion smaller trawlers, especially in these parts. In terms of coverage, I don't know of any press that covers this realm of fishing. You know, there's recreational fishing, and there's, you know, there are publications that cover the outer limits of the fishing business, but not the fishing, you know, trawling business.
In this series, there's two mysteries set up. There's two guys who were thrown overboard, and one of whom survived, you were looking for, basically. And then there's this cell phone footage that was found in a cab in Fiji?
Correct, in a taxi.
Fiji that shows another group of people who've been thrown overboard and then are shot in the water. And in the course of the story, you find the guy who was thrown overboard and lived, but you don't fully resolve the question of who was shooting these guys in the water. When you're pursuing a story like that and you're investigating these strands, are you, like, is solving the mysteries the primary goal? Or when do you know that you have enough that you can publish something?
Yes, is the answer.
are you not even trying to solve these crimes? No.
Yes, the hope is always to solve questions, but with a certain humility that some of the questions may be really tough to solve, and you may just start things. It was a huge coup for us to find the stowaway. That was a major score. We knew that there were two stowaways that had been put onto a raft in the middle of the ocean and cut loose. And the raft had survived a huge storm and eventually washed up in Liberia. And one guy lived. That's all we knew. We didn't know his name, and we certainly didn't know where he was. So through lots of scramble and gumshoe and luck, we found that guy. And amazingly enough, he was in a stowaway shanty town 20 feet from where he had originally boarded the ship. You know, so we come full circle. So that, just finding him was a big coup. And then getting to know him, shadowing him, kind of chronicling his life and finding out from him what it was like to live through that was another sort of stage of challenge. The shooting video was very frustrating. I became a bit obsessed with that, and I still cannot understand how a murder of five men, for at least four men, can occur on camera, at the end of which some of those involved pose for selfies, and it gets on the internet, and still there's been no justice, there's been no real investigation. That just boggles the mind. And the video is more gruesome in full form than even the one that we put on the website. We moved the ball forward on it, but we certainly didn't solve it.
Yeah, so I'm interested in where did the ball start there? And you're not a policeman. You don't have formal training in how to solve a crime. How does a reporter investigate a crime like that?
So, you know, the saying is reporters don't know anything. They know people who know things, if you're a good reporter. And so on every challenge like this, you just have to figure out who can help you and who will know what you certainly don't and will never. So with this video, it became a process of finding sources at Interpol, sources at the countries that had partially looked into the video because they were concerned that it might involve some of their citizens, either as victims or as culprits, and also just sort of naval intelligence types who, at this point in the series, I had lucked out and had some good sources on that front, both U.S. and abroad. And so the first break was pinning down one of the ships at the scene. There were four tuna longliners that were at the scene of the crime, and they're caught on video. And one of them, you can make out the IMO number. It's license plate number, essentially. And once you see that, you can ID the ship. Once you do that, you can get to the owner of the ship. And so we did all that, and we got to the CEO of the company that owns the ship and interviewed him. That was a dead. I mean, he wasn't giving us much to go on.
Yeah, I wasn't there. I was not
right.
There.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the owner of that ship was in Taiwan, and the ship was Taiwanese, and so that added further complication. You know, FOIA and open records laws are not particularly strong in Taiwan, so getting extra information was not easy. But yeah, so you recruit help from those who might be in the know. For example, there's a tracking system called VMS, and it is a hardwired satellite system that's in certain ships on the better end that some governments require ships to have, and it tracks them. And you can't tamper with it. You can't turn it off.
It's like a black box.
It's a black box. Yeah. And it's real-time, you know, conveying data back to, you know, the fisheries management or flagging authority in that country. And Taiwan requires its ships to have VMS, which is great. One of the big mysteries was where and when did this shooting happen? And if we know one of the ships, and we know that ship is Taiwanese, we know it has VMS, and we know we could get its locational information for the last 2 years at all points.
Does it mean if you find a ship that's Taiwanese that's hanging out with three other ships, is the gut instinct there these are all Taiwanese ships then?
It's a really good question. So first of all, you listen to the language on the video, and there are a lot of languages, but it's mostly Chinese, both Cantonese and Mandarin, Thai, some Indonesian languages. So it's a mixed crew, but the voices that seem to be close to or holding the gun are speaking Mandarin. So that tells you a little bit about the ships, possibly. What everyone said of sources who study this stuff is that you don't rob a bank in mixed company. You don't engage in a killing that takes 10 minutes and 26 seconds and people are filming and you know it, unless you know the other folks who are around. So most security folks I talked to said, I bet you if you can pin down that one ship, that there's a good chance the other ships are somehow associated. But we could never prove that.
Did you have suspicions that you were not able to put into the article about that killing because you could not independently corroborate them?
The one I just said is a perfect example. Yeah, and I say that now framed as, just as you say, a suspicion.
Yeah.
It's only that. It's a strong suspicion. It was well reported, but it didn't feel strong enough to put in writing because you'd have to qualify it like I'm doing now.
And there was never an ability to jump from what the ship was to who was on the ship.
So we pressed really hard, tried to bring lawmakers in, law enforcement, you know, because we had one foothold with the owner of this company and the owner of the one known ship. And we knew that he had been approached by law enforcement and told to contact the captain of that ship that was at the scene. That ship that was at the scene is still out to sea and was at sea 3 months ago when we were squeezing this guy. And so he, the owner, contacted the captain, got a full report of what he saw, and wrote it up, handed over to law enforcement. If that owner of the company wanted to, he could give us a full crew list of who was on the ship. And those are other witnesses to the crime. He could also tell us whether there was an official inspector. Some of these ships carry government inspectors on board at times. He could tell us lots of things, but he didn't want to. And the hope is that maybe some of these things may still happen. Someone will pressure the government or the owner of the company to cough up more information.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of my biggest reactions after reading the whole series is when you read an article, one comes to mind from the Times is the article about nail salons in New York City. You're like, wow, this is outrageous. There is actually a legal recourse. There are now laws being changed to protect workers here. When it comes to something like maritime law, is there any chance that, you know, this stuff coming out can change anything? And where would that come from?
Yeah, so just to pull back for a second, I do think that one of the challenges of these type of series or this type of journalism, when you take on targets that are really sprawling, is that it's tough to show or measure impact. I think a lot of editors and venues steer clear of them for that very reason. And I think that's too bad because it means we don't take on some of the toughest problems.
Is impact something that's in your mind while you're working on the story? Like, how can I tell a story that has a maximum impact?
Look, I'd be lying if I didn't admit that every journalist wants to be able to, like nail salons, which is amazing, point to concrete metrics of accomplishment. But at the same time, I sort of felt like the series, we should do it even if we can't point to that. And I thought it was going to be hard for me to imagine what the metrics would look like. There are specifics, you know, that could occur. You know, there's a law, you know, lawmakers in Tanzania who are thinking about sort of figuring out a way to ensure that stowaways or other migrants at sea have some sort of recourse, like in cases like this, what happened to George Mndalwa. There's pressure in Taiwan to require more transparency among its fishing fleet, both in terms of reporting crime, reporting of, you know, whenever they have an engagement that requires a firing of an arm. You know, there's very little requirements in that way. But the meta system, you know, of what happens on the high seas is a big sprawling problem. And I guess the hope is that by explaining and highlighting it in a way that hasn't been done before, you get conversations going at the UN and IMO, and those who've been arguing for bigger fixes have some leverage.
I looked back in your archive of writing, and you seem like you came to it later than some people. I mean, that may be inaccurate. Maybe the stuff's not online. Like, how long have you been a reporter?
Since 2003.
Random
Times.
Yeah, since. And so I'm curious as to how you developed these skills. Like the in the case of trying to find these guys murdered, this is an extremely complicated research task. Where did you pick up this kind of like deep investigation skill set?
I don't know that there's a skill set that's distinct to investigations. Mm-hmm. I do think there's a skill set that's distinct to big projects. So I guess what I'm saying is if you're going to work on something for a year and a half like this and you're going to process a lot of information, I think you have to be extremely organized and have systems that work for you for keeping track of all the information. In some ways, that's much harder than finding the information. It's keeping it organized so that something that doesn't look very promising now, in 6 months, when you realize, wait a minute, I've heard that before, you can get back to that little thing that you're trying to get back to that you recall someone mentioning 6 months ago. So I think that's a skill, and that's something that I'm always trying to get better at. Grad school definitely trained me to process lots of material and figure out a way to condense it down and organize it in your head or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, I think it's also just sort of the basic skills that any good reporter will have, which is, you know, an ability to size up people and to be willing to ask really dumb, seemingly dumb questions, and to also be really pushy and to go places where that aren't very pleasant. You know, these sort of basic skills,
yeah,
I think, are what make the difference.
I always wonder when people, that's probably the most common piece of advice that occurs on the show. And I always wonder, like, if you're not pushy, how do you become pushy? Like, were you pushy to begin with, or are you just professionally
yes,
pushy?
My mom, you know, always called me the nudge. I don't know if that's a word that other people use, but it was her loving way of saying, you know, even as a 9-year-old, that I was kind of pushing. So I think I was somewhat destined for this kind of work.
So one part of this work is the deep research, like staying organized, like really having your mind wrapped around a lot of facts. And then after that's all done, you have to turn this into the poster child narrative. What's the process of taking like reams and reams and reams of research and turning it into like a catchy story like for you?
You know, I'm sort of learning all this as I go, and I think I'm slowly getting better at it, but I look at other people that I think do it even, you know, or much better. I had an editor a long time ago named Kevin Flynn, who's a great investigative reporter and editor at the time, still there. And he sort of described a system he had, which was he's an old schooler, and he printed everything out and kept stacks, and he would force himself to write a cover sheet every 50 pages or some metric, and the cover sheet would condense the stuff underneath. And it was an exercise in reducing, and then he would just read the cover sheets, and then, you know, he would build upward. And I do that sort of digitally, in that when there's something interesting, I have no idea how it will fit in some larger structure, but in and of itself, it's fascinating. I write up a nugget, you know, and it's usually a paragraph or three paragraphs long, and it attempts to be sort of a single thought.
Is that written in the style of New York Times prose when you do it? Are you trying to sort of try it out as a sample?
Yeah, I mean, it's rough. It's very rough. But yes, I try to, because the one thing that I've found is in prior projects, and I think a lot of people fall into this pitfall, you want to report, now stop and write. And I think that's a terrible idea, because writing is something that you, at least I, can only do in spurts.
Yeah.
And then there's a diminishing returns. And so it's better to do it throughout. And so every day you do a little bit of attempted polished writing, attempted polished condensation. And a lot of those nuggets just end up in Google Docs and never see the light of day. But if you do it all the while, then you end up with a 20-page document with nuggets, and you start realizing, well, wait, that little thought kind of connects to this overthought, and patterns emerge, and they start sort of like cells kind of coalescing into bigger things. And then the question is, well, how do you make it a narrative? You need an arc. And that's usually where your character comes in, and also where your editor comes in and sort of says, okay, the architecture here shouldn't be a flat surface. It needs to be, you know, something that... And I also have something called tidbits, which is when I read...
Not nugs. This is the tidbits
exactly.
folder.
So you're seeing the OCD here. You know, there's a whole system.
It's good that you have good names for them, though. Have you ever had to explain to anyone the difference between nuggets and tidbits?
I have to my lots of people. But, you know, and that's where it's one line. It's a turn of phrase that I read somewhere where I'm like, that's beautiful. That's perfect. I'm going to find, you know, or it's a one line factoid that I'm like, I'm not sure where I'll use that, but somewhere that's going to get used. So it's just small flecks of things.
So tidbits are kind of other people's nuggets.
Or things I think up. I hear in a totally different context. I'm reading the nut graph of a story about, you know, car investigation, the New Yorker, you know, by Malcolm Gladwell. And I'm like, whoa, that's a really interesting thought. It feels like it could connect to what I'm doing. Let me put it in tidbits. So
that's a good. There's somewhere a student right now is like opening a nuggets and a tidbits folder. In addition to the nuggets and tidbits, is there a like long-term ideas, project ideas?
I have a folder where when I see a really interesting piece,
I was actually just trying to prod you to tell me what the name of that folder is.
Hack in. They're not. You'll be underwhelmed at what's in there.
Thank you very much for coming in, Ian. It was a pleasure. I love when people come in right when they've done a story like this, because you got it all in your mind.
I appreciate it. No, it's great fun.
Hey, that was the Longform Podcast. Thanks very much to Ian Urbina for coming in on short notice on the trip from his home in Washington. Thanks to New York Times for helping set that up. Thank you to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff, our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman, our intern, Molly Bain. As you may have heard at the front of this show, we're having a third anniversary party for the Longform Podcast in August in New York. We'd love to have you there. If you want to come, write a review of the show on iTunes, then send us an email to podcast@longform.org. Tell us what your screen name, handle, whatever is with Apple,
We will verify that you have indeed written such a review, and then we'll throw your name in a hat and we'll pick a few out to attend this party where you will get to meet the illustrious guests from this show. We'll be back here next week. Thanks for listening.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.